helping you make informed decisions for your life. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well, their father's health did slowly go by, and feed them on your dream, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education, with your hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. This program will give parents and educators the skills and methods to effectively advocate for children today. And now, here's Rich and Michelle.
Welcome to this week's episode of Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. I'm Michelle Davis, and we're here with my co-host Rich Weinfeld. And our show is about excellence in education. It's about exploring issues in schools that can make the difference between what we are and what we could be as a society. Rich and I believe that with high expectations and an education system that works, all children can achieve. This show is for educators, it's for parents, it's for students, and it's for anyone who has a stake in our national education system. And children are our best natural resources, so we're going to teach them well and create an education system that works to develop a future of leaders who make our world a better place to be. And today's show forwards that mission, and we are so pleased to describe today's show, and its title is School Choice and Vouchers, Pros and Cons. School choice is in demand from parents and communities across the nation. What would be the effect of our schools in our nation of school choice? Does school choice mean the downfall of public education? What factors do parents consider when they elect to send their children to independent, private, or parochial schools? And how will parents make an informed decision about school choice? Why are public school educators and administrators against the idea? And are vouchers working to give children what they need to lead independent lives and level the playing field? We have two very distinguished guests today, and Rich, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guests today?
Okay, Michelle, it's my pleasure to introduce Susan Nogan and Andrew Colson, our two guests today. And let me tell you a little bit about each of them, and then we're going to have them give us their positions on this important issue. Susan Nogan is a senior policy analyst in the National Education Association's Office of Education Policy and Practice. There, she analyzes national and state initiatives that would have a negative impact on public education or the rights of NEA's members. Vouchers are, of course, included in Susan's work. She also provides opposition research on the foundations, advocacy organizations, and other entities that promote these initiatives and evaluates materials produced by their think tanks. Prior to joining NEA in 2003, Ms. Nogan served as a federal lobbyist with the National PTA, where she chaired a national coalition of education, labor, civil rights, and civil liberties, religious and other advocacy organizations that oppose, civil rights and civil liberties. Before becoming an advocate for education, Ms. Nogan practiced law in New York City. She earned her law degree and a master's degree in history at New York University and her undergraduate degree at Duke University. Our other guest is Andrew Colson. Mr. Colson is the director of Cato's Center for Educational Freedom. He's the author of the 1999 book Market Education, The Unknown History, and a contributor to books published by the Fraser Institute and the Hoover Institution. Colson has written for numerous academic journals, including the Journal of Research and the Teaching of English and Education Policy Analyst Archives, for numerous newspapers as well. He currently serves on the advisory council of the E.G. West Center for Market Solutions in Education at the University of Newcastle in the U.K. Colson was a senior fellow in education policy at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy and is editor of School Choices. Prior to entering the field of education a decade ago, he was a systems software engineer with Microsoft Corporation. So I want to welcome Susan Nogan and Andrew Colson, and I want to start off with you, Andrew. First of all, thanks for being with us today, and if you could just start us off by giving us a little bit of an introduction to what are vouchers, how do they work, and why do you support them? Well, I just wanted to start actually by going to a question that you ask in the setup to the show, asking whether vouchers would be harmful to be the downfall of public education. And I think it's really important to understand the difference between the ideals of public education and the institution of public schooling. We use these terms interchangeably all the time, public schooling and public education, but really we're talking about two different things. Public education is a set of goals, a set of ideals. We want all kids to have access to good schools. We want schools to prepare kids for success in public and private life. We have these various goals. Public schooling is just one approach to fulfilling those goals. And so what I'm suggesting with the findings of my research are is that systems which are driven by the choices of parents, in which schools have to compete for the opportunity to serve each and every child, these kinds of systems do a better job of fulfilling the ideals of public education than our traditional district-run, tax-funded state school systems do. And so I would say that far from being a threat to public education, school choice programs, either vouchers or a policy that I prefer, education tax credits, are a better way of fulfilling our ideals of public education.
Okay, thank you. And we'll obviously have lots of follow-up questions about what you've just said, but I want to give Susan Nogan a chance to just kind of put out there your position, NEA's position, about vouchers and school choice.
Okay, well, thanks, Rich, and thanks, Michelle, for the opportunity to be on. I'll go ahead and answer the question that you asked. NEA believes that every child has a basic right to a great public school. So in order to achieve that, we believe you should prioritize investing in school improvement strategies that have been proven effective. Since private school vouchers have not been proven effective, then we shouldn't be investing in them. There's also huge accountability issues, access issues, and other issues that we can explore further as the show proceeds. But basically, let's invest in what works, and vouchers aren't it.
Andrew, in your opening statement, you alluded to the fact that vouchers are working, or school choice is working. What evidence do you have of that?
Right. Here again, it's important to distinguish between vouchers as a tool and free enterprise system of education or a competitive market in education as the actual goal. Existing voucher programs in the United States are actually very different from the kinds of competitive education markets that I recommend. The existing programs are too small to create market forces. They impose considerable limits on private schools and constrain the choices of families. And so if we really want to know what a large-scale market reform in education could accomplish, what real large-scale public and private school choice should accomplish or could accomplish, we have to look abroad because there just aren't examples within the United States that we can study meaningfully. And so I've spent the past 10 years looking at different education systems from classical Greece all the way to the present and from all over the world, and I'm coming out in a few weeks with a comparative study of market systems of education and state-run monopoly systems of education. If you look at this international research, which is done mostly by economists of education, you find the evidence overwhelmingly favors education systems in which parents are doing the choosing and in which regulation is minimal, in which schools are operated privately, systems in which the state makes the major decisions and are funded fully by the state, and it's very heavily regulated. These kinds of systems do very poorly by comparison.
Andrew and Susan, can you help us to understand, just give us some background and some detail about how current voucher programs might work, how tax programs might work, how do people get selected for this? Is it only schools that are not making the grade under No Child Left Behind, or is it only parents who are in lower socioeconomic statuses who can apply and get different supports for school choice? Can you tell us about that? Susan, why don't we start off with you and then go to Andrew?
Okay, sure. There are a number of voucher programs in existence right now. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Cleveland, Washington, D.C. There is a tax credit voucher program in Florida, as well as a voucher program for children with special needs in Florida. The special needs one has no income limitation. Any parent who's dissatisfied with the services they're getting in the public school can apply for one. However, the IEP does not follow the child in that case.
Yeah, I have some personal experience with that, with the McKay vouchers. And, for example, a child who has been identified with special needs through the public school system might be attending, let's say, a Catholic school or a private school of that person's choice.
That's right. But the private school, IDEA does not apply to private schools.
Yeah.
So the private school does not have to provide the special services or accommodations that the parents and the teachers who were on the IEP team determined were essential for that child.
So is the NEA basically saying that any money that would be given to parents to support any type of school choice option should be kept within the public school system?
I think you're conflating two issues there, but if the question is, does NEA support public school choice, yes.
Got it.
Okay.
I want to go back to Andrew. You've talked about there are examples overseas. Can you, for our listeners who might be brand new to this issue, can you kind of give us the nuts and bolts of how, in an ideal voucher system or tax credit system, how would it work?
Well, two separate questions there. What countries are doing various things on school choice, and then what would an ideal system work like? Other countries that are doing that have been doing school choice programs for a long period of time include countries like the Netherlands. Back in 1917, the Netherlands was on the verge of a civil war over what was being taught in the public schools. They had public schools, had had them for much longer than the U.S. had, but they were religious schools, and nobody could agree on exactly what kind of religion should be taught, so they nearly had a civil war over this. And they decided instead they would just give the money to parents. Any school that could show it had demand would get government funding. And it created essentially a universal school voucher program nationwide. And so this Dutch program has continued to this day, although it's gotten very heavily regulated over time. There are still public and private schools, and the private schools can be religious or secular. And parents have a lot more choices in the Netherlands than they do in most other countries. There are other countries that have nationwide voucher programs like Chile. But none of these programs in the rich countries are really the sort of free market programs that we advocate based on our international and historical research. And the reason is that they tend to be much more heavily regulated than a normal marketplace. I mean, if you go out to buy something, you know, if you go out to buy a pair of shoes or a book, the government isn't restricting what can be offered to you and what you can pay. So we're looking at that kind of free marketplace. And interestingly enough, where you find this sort of thing most often is in the developing world, in very poor countries. A friend of mine, James Tooley, does research in the poorest countries on earth, in the slums of India and Africa, and he's found that in many of these places, the public schools are so bad that these incredibly destitute families are actually paying for fee-charging private schooling.
Andrew, I'm going to break in a minute because we're going to go to break, and when we come back, I want to really find out how would it work here in the United States. We'll continue after the break.
You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Chelsea School has served as a beacon of hope for students with language-based learning disabilities in the Washington, D.C. metro area for over 32 years. It is a college preparatory school serving students grades 5 through 12. Our program model emphasizes literacy remediation, math, science, and technology. For more information, visit our website at www.chelseaschool.edu or call 301-585-1430, extension 303.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators educators. Do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. I'm Rich Weinfeld along with my co-host Michelle Davis. And we have two wonderful guests today, Andrew Colson and Susan Nogan, talking about the issues of vouchers and school choice. And Andrew, I cut you off right as we had to go to break, but I wanted to switch the focus to the second part of my question, which is I want it as clear as you can articulate it. What is your group? What are you proposing for the United States in this matter?
The kind of policy we recommend is an education tax credit program that basically cuts your taxes if you pay for a child's education. And so this has two parts, really. There's a tax credit for parents who pay for their own children's education, for instance, against state sales taxes or local property taxes. And then there's a tax credit for businesses and other individuals who may not have children of their own but who want to donate to a private scholarship fund, a program that exists, for instance, in Florida and Arizona. The business or the individual makes a donation to the scholarship fund, and the scholarship fund pays for the education of a low-income child at a private school. And so with this two-part system, it's possible to make public and private schooling within easy reach of all families without actually involving the state in paying directly for the schooling itself.
Andrew, just to follow up with that, you know, if parents can save money or if parents can receive money to support their children's education, and, you know, educational freedom, I think, their freedom of choice is a main goal. Given the cost of, let's say, private education or education across districts, you know, even if I cross a district line and I'm allowed to send my child to the next county over, their tuition might be, you know, much higher than my tuition in my district, or even just the cost of tutors. I've seen some of these programs have caps on them that seem so minute, you know, $2,000, $2,600, that really seems to provide a barrier for parents to really engage in the school choice. I mean, are there caps, and how would that work?
Yeah, absolutely. And, in fact, these caps are one of the reasons that existing school choice programs in the U.S., particularly existing tax credit programs, have had a limited impact to date. The kind of policy we're recommending doesn't have a total cap on the amount of money that can be donated, and at a per-student level, it caps the value of the total credits at 80% of what is spent currently in the public schools per pupil. And this is a good sort of ballpark starting point, because on average, the tuition of U.S. private schools is a little over half of the per-pupil spending in public schools. And then when you take into account the fact that private schools have some other sources of income, private schools are still considerably less expensive per pupil. So if we set the tax credit value at 80% of the average public school spending, this covers the vast majority of private schools in the U.S.
Susan, I'd love for you to get back in and respond to some of the things that Andrew has said.
Oh, sure. One of the things that should be noted about the individual tax credit is that these disproportionately benefit wealthy taxpayers. These are the people who have the resources to pay tuition up front and wait for a tax credit. Families whose income is so low that they don't owe income taxes at all get no benefit from these. In terms of the tax credit vouchers, the impact of these is that they reduce state revenue. So, for example, the cap in Florida is $238 million. That's $238 million less that the state has to spend on things like public education. In addition to reducing the state revenue, it also, there is absolutely no accountability. The taxpayer has no say over how this money gets spent. So it expands parents' choices, but the taxpayers are the ones who are footing the bill, and they get no say-so over what the criteria are for teacher qualifications, what the curriculum standards are, whether these schools can discriminate in their admission standards, in their employment practices. So the accountability issue is just huge.
I'll direct this to Andrew first and then to Susan. Michelle and I both watched an HBO documentary this week, Hard Times at Frederick Douglass High, which was the portrait of an inner-city school in Baltimore that is really, really struggling. I think 10% of students were proficient on the state exam.
Algebra.
Algebra might have been 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we both came away, you know, with a very depressing feel about the state of the school. So the question is, first to Andrew, if there was a voucher system in place in Baltimore and these families had a choice of another school, it's hard for me to imagine what happens to Frederick Douglass High School. What happens if some of the kids opt out and that funding is taken away from the school? Does the school just fall into further disrepair? Does that matter to you? Do you just let market forces take over and however number of years it takes for it to disintegrate is fine? Or what? How do you provide for that?
Well, what that really highlights is the fact that markets have a much better effect on good and bad schools than the kind of system we have today does. In a marketplace, when a provider is providing a really bad service, as such as this particular public school happens to be, that company eventually loses enough customers that it goes out of business, and this can happen actually quite rapidly. And so good schools are constantly attracting students away from bad schools, and the bad schools are going out of existence. And that's the sort of scenario that we want. There's no scenario where you can have only perfect schools. So you want the one where the bad schools go out of existence. But in the current system that we have today, the bad schools linger on year after year, just decimating the hopes of the students who are sent to them. So what you want is for a school like this to go out of existence as quickly as possible and be replaced by better ones that actually satisfy families.
Susan, what would you do with a school like Frederick Douglass High School in Baltimore?
Well, I think this clearly demonstrates the flaws of a free market system. There are winners and losers, and in education we cannot afford to have losers and just say that these kids will be in a school that is just going to go out of business and we don't care what happens to those kids. We can't do that. Instead of giving a few kids an option to take a voucher and go someplace else that might or might not be better, they haven't been proven better, let's do intensive interventions into that school to make it better for all of the kids who are there.
There's one of the most important factors that goes back to mine and Rich's first show, which aired in April of this year, and was really on how to make better teachers. And we picked up on a Time Magazine article by Claudia Wallace, we had a wonderful guest who talked to us about the importance of the quality of the human being in the classroom. And in this documentary, for example, in the high school English class, there were 5 long-term substitutes. The teacher quit in the middle of the year because of the poor performance of the school. He just, and we know that our new teachers are just taking flight from this field. How in any of these scenarios do we, because the school population is may or may not change, how under any of these programs do we attract quality, high-performing teachers? And Susan, I guess let's start with you and then have Andrew take us to break again.
Okay, well, we can start by offering professional salaries and by having mentoring programs, so we're not throwing new teachers to the wolves in situations where they have no support and no guidance. So okay. Those would be 2 ways to start.
Okay, Andrew?
Well, one of the unique things about the public education industry in the United States and in a lot of countries is that, unlike virtually every other field, the people working in the system are not paid based on their performance. In most jobs, if you do a very poor job, you get a lower salary than someone who does an excellent job. but in the public school system, typically salary is dependent on your academic credentials, what your highest degree is, and how long you've worked within the system. And these two things may sometimes be correlated with quality and sometimes not. So that's why a more market-based system in which people are paid based on their performance is a much better way to go for attracting the best talent and keeping the best talent.
One of the criticisms of the voucher proposal program, school choice program, is that private schools aren't accountable to oversight, whereas public schools are. And so, you know, you're saying the market would drive that oversight, but, you know, what assurances are there that it will really be based on teacher quality and student performance rather than just filling the seats or, you know, sales?
Well, as mentioned, I have just completed the draft of a study comparing market and monopoly school systems internationally using research that's been done over the past 25 years, and I'm actually looking at the chart and table on my computer as I speak with you. The two most studied areas are academic achievement and efficiency, which is basically test scores that students achieve per dollar that the school spends. And in academic achievement, there are 15 studies finding markets are better than monopolies, and there's only one study finding that monopolies are better than markets. In efficiency, there are no studies finding that monopolies are better, and 14 finding that markets are better. So the evidence is just overwhelming that a competitive market environment stimulates the drive for quality and meets the needs that we have for efficiency. There's just very little contrary evidence.
Susan, last word before break. Any difference on that?
Well, I, you know, I can't respond to research I haven't seen and evidence that's also unseen. I can comment on what the impact has been in Chile, which is one of the countries that Andrew mentioned, and it's turned into a completely tiered system. So the highest, the elite schools do not accept the state voucher. The middle schools accept the voucher, but parents can top up. And the lowest schools are the ones that accept the voucher as payment in full. And the performance is tiered as well. So the wealthiest get the best schools and the poorest get the short end.
We're going to continue after break with Susan and Andrew and follow up on some of these issues. Be back after break.
They see the truth before they...
Your life, your health, your network. Voice America Health and Wellness.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators, do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
Chelsea School has served as a beacon of hope for students with language-based learning disabilities in the Washington, D.C. metro area for over 32 years. It is a college preparatory school serving students grades 5 through 12. Our program model emphasizes literacy remediation, math, science, and technology. For more information, visit our website at www.chelseaschool.edu or call 301-585-1430, extension 303.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Back
to Teach Your Children Well. This is Michelle Davis, and I'm here with my co-host, Rich Weinfeld. I wanted to mention that in addition to the number that listeners can call into and ask questions and make comments to our distinguished guest today, we also have an email address where you can email us questions, thoughts, and comments about our different topics. And today's topic is obviously school choice and voucher programs. That email address is specialneedsadvocacy@msn.com. Again, specialneeds, advocacy, advocacy, at msn.com. Susan and Andrew, before we took our break, we were starting to talk a little bit about merit pay and that issue, and would schools who pay teachers, like in the private world, based on their performance, you know, improve the performance of the overall school and specifically their classroom. And I, being an educator, and Rich being an educator, we're aware that we know that teachers and educators are concerned that the constellations of different classrooms provide teachers with different factors that may provide an unequal playing field, to put it simply. If I'm a special educator and I'm teaching students with very significant reading disabilities, for example, versus I'm a teacher of highly able readers who are in advanced placement courses, how does a merit pay or kind of a privatization concept work, or how does merit pay work within the public school system related to the different factors that different classrooms bring in? Andrew, would you like to take your first answer at that?
Sure. I think the idea that it's impossible for a market to respond to the different classroom makeup that different teachers will have shows a lack of understanding of how the private sector works. There are very, very few jobs that you could have in the private sector where the tasks that you're assigned will be identical, exactly identical to the tasks of your colleagues. And so it's never the case that a manager in the private sector can say, well, I've assigned exactly the same task to all of you, and the output from John has been higher, or Betty has been higher, and therefore John or Betty will get the raise. The way it works in the private sector is that managers know that some tasks they assign to their employees are more challenging than others, and they consider that when they assign performance-based pay. And they have a tremendous incentive to do a good job assigning merit and assigning pay, because if they don't, if they, say, underestimate the contribution of one of their employees, that employee who's talented will go off and leave for another company. And similarly, if they waste money on employees who have not contributed much, their own generation of revenue for the company will be hurt, and they'll be hurt professionally. So there's a feedback system that encourages managers to make these decisions wisely.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. We're in the Washington, D.C. area, and in an adjoining Maryland suburb, Prince George's County Public Schools, which unfortunately is not rated very high within the United States in terms of performance when compared to equally sized counties, is proposing, I think, in 12 schools to offer up to $10,000 for effective teachers. And this is not going outside the public school system. Susan, what are your ideas on this topic and how the different factors of different classrooms might be managed?
I have to confess that alternative compensation is not my area of expertise. What I can tell you is that the conversation should clarify that we're not talking about pay for test scores, pay for performance.
I'm glad you said that. Mm-hmm.
I think the subject is much more broad than that, and alternative compensation is pay that is not based on a single salary schedule. It can include incentives for achievement of national board certification, for example, or employment in a low-performing or a hard-to-staff school. So the key is to make sure that the teachers are involved in negotiating whatever the schedule is, so that to ensure that it's going to be fair to everyone.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit, going back to Andrew. Public schools must accept everyone, regardless of their disabilities. Private schools can show favoritism. They can choose one clientele they want, others that they don't want.
what happens in the free market system to students with disabilities, particularly to students with disabilities that are very hard to manage, very expensive to manage?
Well, a couple of things. One, there's a myth that public schools must and do accept everyone. There is no single public school that must or does accept every student who might possibly be assigned to it or choose it. It's true that the public school system as a whole is expected to serve all students, but even there, the public school system nationwide, in fact, no, just in 22 states, there was a study done back in 1997, found that in just 22 states, 200,000 students are assigned by public schools to private education providers, specialty providers, special education providers, because the public school districts in question did not have the capacity to serve those students. So already, even without a voucher program, many, many students are being sent by the public school system to the private sector, specifically because the private sector is better able to cater to niche markets. And on a more broad level, Florida, as you've already discussed, has already implemented a McKay voucher program for special needs students. And the value of the vouchers under this program range from a few thousand dollars to $22,000. And parental satisfaction is just absolutely off the charts with that program.
Yes, Michelle and I do a lot of advocacy work for parents, help them finding the correct placement. So we certainly both resonate with what you said, Andrew, about private schools serving some of the toughest disabilities. Susan, how would you respond to that? How does NEA see the fate of kids with disabilities under a voucher system?
Well, the first thing is the distinction between the district placement and a private placement. In the cases that Andrew mentioned where students are assigned to a private school because the district lacks the capacity to adequately serve that child, the IEP still applies. The private school under contract agrees to provide the services that child needs. Mm-hmm. In a voucher program, that is not the case. None of the services need to be applied, and the only recourse parents have is to either put their child back in the public school or try and find another private school. The private school that they go to does not have to comply with IDEA.
And
the other issue about the McKay vouchers being up to $22,000, the private schools can decide which students to take and which they will not. And they can discriminate based on the degree of disability. So they're not going to take everybody. In terms of parent satisfaction, the parent satisfaction surveys were only done on the parents who took the survey. So you have a skewed population to start off with. The 97% of the eligible students who stayed in the public school were not surveyed.
I'd like to go back to Andrew just quickly. The issue of IEPs having to be followed by private schools has come up a couple times. How would you respond to that?
Well, basically, I think it should be up to the people who know most about the child and care most about the child. If the parents think that their child will receive a better education in the private sector in a setting not governed by an IEP, I think that they are the ones who are both most rightfully capable of making that decision and probably best informed on the value of that decision, and that it should be left up to the family.
Yes, Andrew, you've been, and Susan, this has been a great discussion. And Andrew, I know that you are stretching your time just to, you know, stay with us through this break. And so I wanted to take advantage of a question about No Child Left Behind and then allow you to make any other points that you'd like to make. And this is for both of you, Andrew, starting out, what about No Child Left Behind? I am aware that, there's an article, Mend It, Don't End It. There's a lot of controversy about whether it should stay or go, whether it should be changed. What is your view on that, and do you have any other last points that you'd like to make?
Yeah, based on the research, there was no reason to think that No Child Left Behind would do a great deal of good even before it was passed. And since it was passed, it has not, in fact, had much of an effect on achievement. There are some upticks at certain grades and tests on the National Assessment of Education Progress, but in fact, the upward trends on those tests predate the No Child Left Behind Act. Those scores were already rising before it was passed, And in fact, the rate of improvement has slowed in many cases after No Child Left Behind. Then there are two international tests that were released last November and December. They're called PISA and PEARLS. They're acronyms. Those two tests show that in every subject, at every grade, on both tests, there have been score declines for U.S. students since 2000 or 2001 to the present. And some of those declines are statistically significant, the ones in mathematics and science. And so there isn't a lot of evidence that No Child Left Behind has done any good, and there wasn't much reason to expect that it would. There also, for what it's worth, is no constitutional mandate for the federal government to be making such laws. The words education and school don't appear in our Constitution, so people who care about the rule of law might question the idea of the federal government doing things it's not authorized to do. But just to follow up on some of Susan's points, Susan had a lot of very good points about the financial impact of school choice programs, accountability. All these things are very important, and they need to be resolved effectively before we go forward with large-scale school choice programs. Certainly, we're working on some of these issues, and we have a fiscal impact analysis for our model tax credit legislation coming out in a week or two. And we find in all five states for which we have the necessary data that it would generate substantial savings over time. And the reason is that, yes, you lose tax revenue when a child moves to the private sector from a public school, but you also no longer have to pay for that child's education, and so there's a commensurate savings. And on the whole, you can save up to billions of dollars after the program has been running for 8 or 10 years. And then from the standpoint of accountability, it's very important that taxpayers have some level of accountability, and right now they don't really have any. You have to pay your education taxes, whether you think your local public school district is completely dysfunctional or is the best district on earth.
That's why so many people have a stake in education.
Yes, and under a scholarship tax credit program, you actually have a choice as a taxpayer. The system is accountable to you. If you don't like your local public school district's performance, you can give to a scholarship fund that will make private schooling available to local children. And you get to choose which scholarship fund will receive your money, giving you even more accountability.
Andrew, I don't mean to cut you off, but we have 30 seconds until the break. Can you tell people where to find your new research and how to find you possibly online? Give us a website.
Yes, absolutely. People should go to www.cato.org, which is C-A-T-O.org, or our blog, which is cato-at-liberty.org. And all of these studies will be prominently displayed in the coming weeks and months, and there's already a lot of resources available there.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Andrew, and we'll finish up with Susan after the break.
Helping you make informed decisions for your life. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators, do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
Chelsea School has served as a beacon of hope for students with language-based learning disabilities in the Washington, D.C. metro area for over 32 years. It is a college preparatory school serving students grades 5 through 12. Our program model emphasizes literacy remediation, math, science, and technology. For more information, visit our website at www.chelseaschool.edu or call 301-585-1430, extension 303.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your
Children Well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. This is Rich Weinfeld along with my co-host Michelle Davis. We just said goodbye to Andrew Colson, and we're going to give Susan Nogan a chance to kind of sum up and give us some contact information. Susan, I wanted to get your thoughts in closing about No Child Left Behind, and then, you know, any other last points that you'd like to make about the school voucher, school choice issue.
Okay. Well, I would like to direct your listeners to the NEA website that lists our principles for reauthorization. And that's www.nea.org/esea/policy.html. It will provide what our agenda is and the research supporting what we're looking for in the reauthorization.
And in a nutshell, you know, Andrew was saying, end it. What is NEA's position?
Fix it and fund it.
Okay.
Very clear.
And any last words that you'd like to say, you know, just to kind of sum up your position or react to anything Andrew said in his closing?
Okay. Well, just, to wrap up the voucher part of it, again, we believe that we should be investing in proven school improvement strategies. Schools need things like smaller class sizes, up-to-date textbooks, computers, safe buildings, qualified caring teachers, active parent involvement, equitable and adequate funding, high-quality early childhood programs, before and after-school tutoring. These are the things we should be funding instead of programs that have not been proven effective and that are completely unaccountable to the taxpayer.
We appreciate so much you taking your time to be with us today, and really enjoyed having you on the show.
Thank you so much. Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
And we're going to continue on now, and Michelle and I always like to review some hot topics in education and also to preview our upcoming shows. Let me start with that. Next week on July 4th, like many of you, Michelle and I will be off, but we will be replaying one of our most popular shows, and that is a show that featured Jonathan Mooney, author of Learning Outside the Lines and also The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal, and we thought it was a fabulous show with Jonathan where he described his own experiences being a student who suffered with the issues of attention deficit disorder, learning disabilities, and over his own long personal journey became aware of his own strengths and needs and how to advocate for them. So if you didn't hear that show the first time, or even if you did, I think you'll want to tune in and hear that again.
Yes, Rich, that show is really, I think, parents out there and educators who work with students who we say are 2E, twice exceptional, really enjoy that show. And our archives can be, of course, listened to at any time on podcast at voiceamerica.com, but also at specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com.
That's right. And then we're very excited about the week after that when we'll return on July 11th, 2 weeks from today. And we have a definite commitment from Senator McCain's organization. His educational advisor, Lisa Keegan, will be here to talk about how education will be different if Senator McCain is elected to be our next president. And we are hoping to hear any moment from the Obama campaign, and we are in communication with Jean Century, their educational advisor, and we're hoping to have her on the show as well. And of course, we look forward to a very dynamic show with the two of them discussing how education will be different in the United States under either Senator Obama or Senator McCain.
Yes, both of these political campaigns have very strong stances on most of the issues that we've covered in our show, Teacher Children Well, Hot Topics in Education, not only No Child Left Behind and Merit Pay for Teachers, but also the vouchers and school choice programs that we've just talked about with our guest today.
And I think we'll definitely want to revisit, you know, many of the issues that we've discussed in the previous 11 shows, counting today. We'll want to discuss those with the advisors to Senator McCain and Senator Obama and really see where the candidates stand specifically on revamping, changing, keeping, ending No Child Left Behind, and all of the other things that the federal government is involved with when it comes to education.
Absolutely. So, again, that show is going to be on July 11th. And then following Friday, July 18th, is going to be a very interesting and informative Hot Topic show on school violence and bullying. We are so pleased to have national and worldwide leaders with us, confirmed to be our distinguished guests on that show. And, Rich, that's just such an important hot topic. We'll be talking about the national anti-bullying legislation that different states have been proposing, and this is just obviously a very important topic for not only our nation, but for the world as well.
And we'll talk specifically about what are some promising interventions for bullying and school violence. We'll focus on, one of our guests is Nick Dubin, who specifically focuses on bullying as it comes to students with disabilities, particularly students on the autism spectrum. So we'll get into that part of the topic as well, and I agree, we're really looking forward to that.
Absolutely. Rich, did you have any hot topics and articles? I know that we've been scouring the not only Education Week but other national publications. Did you want to go ahead and start?
Several articles related to No Child Left Behind caught my eye the past couple of weeks, and these are reported in Education Week, which is one of the go-to sources, I know, for both of us when we look for what's happening in education. Recent article reported that test scores in general are on the rise since No Child Left Behind came into being. Now, you just heard Andrew say that, you know, there's no cause-effect directly to No Child Left Behind, and I'm sure that could be debated. Another article recently in Education Week talked about that the students making the least gains over that time are the most highly able students. And I know there's lots of concern in the community that of educators and parents that focus on gifted education that, in a way, their kids are being left behind. They're not being paid attention to as programs under No Child Left Behind really focus on the lowest achieving students.
We did talk about that in our show on giftedness several weeks ago.
With George Ventassel-Baska.
Yeah. Absolutely, with Dr. Ventassel-Baska and Dr. Jean Painter.
Right.
And it was very evident that the highly able, highly performing students are don't seem to be keeping pace with the type of progress that other students might be making.
Two of the other articles I just wanted to mention real briefly caught my eye. One was from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and it said, Ohio education grant to study alternatives to standardized testing. And then kind of on the similar kind of theme was an article out of Providence, Rhode Island, talking about a part of their state testing is performance-based. Students are now required to give a presentation as part of their graduation requirements. And I thought that is an interesting subtopic to No Child Left Behind. How can we develop higher order thinking? How can we look at students in ways that aren't just kind of the rote way that many of our tests currently look at them? And I know that's something that's being advocated in the gifted education community. It's actually something that I've seen on Senator Obama's website as one of his critiques of No Child Left Behind, is that more attention should be paid to higher order thinking.
I think, you know, those are excellent points, and of course we'll talk with Senator Obama's camp about that when we have our show on July 11th. I think that before we leave, I'd like to definitely leave the listeners with a website for the United States General Accounting Office, a 54-page report on school vouchers, which was our topic today, and it talks about publicly funded programs in Cleveland and Milwaukee and other parts of the United States. That's at www.gao.gov/new.items. And lastly, Rich, there was a research article out of the University of Colorado at Boulder, and it analyzes the test scores from the Florida public schools, proposing that some of the gains seen in the test scores were really not related to voucher or other types of programs, but were related to the state of Florida's renewed impetus on the instruction of written language. And it kind of makes me wonder, what if the different states had a renewed interest on reading, written language, and math? What would that do to our public schools?
Let's not forget about the higher order thinking. Okay.
Absolutely.
So we're going to close up for today. We invite you to communicate with us. Either probably the best way is via email, even if you just have a thought, a comment, or a question. So please do that. Michelle, want to give that email address again, please?
Yes, that's specialneedsadvocacy@msn.com. Stay tuned.
See you soon. Take care.
Next week. Talk to you then.
Before they can die.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's edition of Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. Join your hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Teach your children well. Their father's health did slowly go.